miles an hour, the barometer holding steady at 29.58. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. First of all, we were expecting, as part one of today's morning show, a visit from Tom Bueller, president of Visioning a Greater Racine. This is an organization that is doing some very exciting long-range visioning and planning about making Racine a better place to live. They have a very special and important event coming up on the 8th of December, which we were going to be talking about today. We hope Mr. Bueller will get here at some point in the hour so we can still have that conversation today. In the meantime, though, the guest slated for part two is with us in the studios, James Schatzman, who is the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. And they have a very special program coming up this weekend. It's their annual Lessons and Carols, which this year is going to focus on the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. And so to get us in the mood for that conversation, we're going to listen to just a little bit of one of the works that will be featured, the opening movement to Johann Sebastian Bach's brilliant Christmas oratorio. So here is a bit of the music of Bach as we begin the morning show today. Music of Johann Sebastian Bach from his Christmas Oratorio. And James Schatzman from the Choral Arts Society, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Good to have you here. So each and every year for the last many years, I forget how many. How many are we?
Close to 25.
You've done a festival of lessons and carols.
Only a very few years have we not done it. We've taken a break maybe twice in that 25 years. But this has been an annual tradition of ours since about our fifth year of existence.
Right. Where you, in a sense, break from tradition, at least I don't remember this happening before, is that this year's lessons and carols is focused entirely on the music of one composer, correct?
That is unique, although we did it one time before. We focused on the music of Handel once, and that's been quite some time, probably 15 or more years ago. And so generally we do it in the more traditional sense where you have a mix of contemporary and ancient carols that you'll share to reflect on each reading. And these pieces also are all a reflection of the reading that's being done at the time. And so they're all still connected in that way, but it's unique to have the music of Bach or one composer all the way through as a kind of a way of binding it together.
And, of course, a very special, let's say, stiff challenge for your singers, since the music of Bach is, there's nothing easy about it. Let's first of all talk about this whole notion of the lessons and carols, which I'm sure many of our listeners are very familiar with, but it's certainly conceivable that some people don't, and I suspect there's plenty of people who don't even really understand the background of it or the history of it. Mm-hmm. Give us some sense of where this tradition comes from, not specifically mm-hmm. choral arts, but
sure.
Lessons and carols in general.
It is an English tradition, and it was built by a bishop from Truro back in the early 20th century. I think 1918 is the year that he developed this concept as a way of celebrating the seasons of Advent and Christmas, and really talking about the almost like Messiah, telling a complete story of the prophecies and the early inklings of Scripture that were leading to the Nativity. And so the readings start from the earliest readings from Genesis and the fall of man and take you through the prophecies of Isaiah, the wonderful counselor that will come. And then next come the early readings of the angel coming to Mary and visiting Mary, and follow right through to the Nativity at the end. The ending is the wonderful, beautiful reading from the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. More kind of tangential about the story. It gives you that theological framework at the end, but in the beginning part, it tells that story all the way through from the beginning. And it's done every year in England. King's College has been doing this now for decades, and it's a big deal. You'll hear it on NPR right around Christmas.
Absolutely.
Christmas Eve, I think, is often when it's done.
Yeah, our time, it's Christmas Eve morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite a remarkable story of word and music blended together and kind of cutting edge in a way. Now it's much more popular to do a marriage of readings and music together in the same program. That was pretty innovative when it first came out. In a way, the church has been doing this through its history, but this is really intentional, take an entire service and build it around a long telling of one story and highlighted with music.
Right, and essentially no sermon. I mean, in some
Correct.
Ways, you know, if you just dropped in for 5 minutes, it feels like you're in church in a fairly mm-hmm. standard worship service, but in fact, there's no sermon with which it
that's
climaxes.
Right. And I think that's wonderful. I think that was by design. There's no interruption to the story itself, and it allows the story of Scripture to tell its own story in its own way without being interrupted, and then highlighted by composers throughout the centuries who have, you know, that's the sermon, really. It's the music after each lesson to give the reader a chance to reflect on that text in a way that this composer thought was important and meaningful. Mm.
I know that the service that people hear from King's College year after year utilizes the same array of readings mm-hmm. year after year, and actually a couple of musical elements I think are also mm-hmm. pretty standard. They always open with that beautiful English carol, Once in Royal David mm-hmm. City. Do you, when you do lessons and carols, adhere to that same strict array of readings, or do you pick and choose? Because I know other churches that do things like this might not necessarily adopt those particular readings.
We have decided to stay with those particular readings. We really stay to the tradition of the readings as they go. And there are some opportunities for alternate readings in there that are given in the English tradition. But we stay pretty much to the same readings. If you're familiar with Lessons and Carols and you love the way that story builds, you'll hear exactly the same thing when you come and hear the Choral Arts Society. So we do, we stay to the program of the of the particular readings, and in the past, I would say there are even some musical similarities we share. That probably 2/3 of the Lessons and Carols we've done has opened with "Once in Rural David City," for example. Mm. My background is English music, and I spent almost 30 years making music in the Anglican Church here in the United States. So I'm really formed in that tradition, and it's really part of what speaks to me in the much the way that Bach speaks to many Lutherans. Sure. It is a core part of Lutheran spirituality and how you view music and its place in the church. And so I think this particular program is going to offer a unique unity where instead of having 30, 15 composers in the course of your program, we really have one kind of icon of music sharing his thought process all the way through this program. So that's what I'm really excited about, but this particular program.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, we're beginning today's morning show with James Schatzman, who is the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. And we are talking about their performances that are coming up this weekend, their annual Lessons and Carols, a performance Saturday evening at the Siena Center, and then Sunday afternoon at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford. And what makes this year's Lessons and Carols distinct from any of the others that they have done is that this year the music will be focused entirely on Johann Sebastian Bach, that towering master from the Baroque era. So, Jim, any particular reason why you decided on Bach? And Bach for this particular Lessons and Carols?
I'm not sure why, but we have a program committee that works with. We work together. A lot of really wonderful musical minds work together to make this happen. And we really thought, you start thinking about what do you want to do in terms of something special when you come around a 30th anniversary. And one of the things that came to people's minds was the music of Bach. He is essentially the icon of the Baroque period, but also Bach is one of those people who just is kind of synonymous with music. I mean, to the average layperson, whether they are familiar with classical music or not, they certainly know the name of Bach, which in itself is interesting to me because Bach nearly disappeared into obscurity like a lot of composers. In that time, music was written for a time and place. And when that composer passed, often the music just kind of passed into obscurity.
Right. Well, many things only performed once, maybe twice, but there was no concept of, I hope in 100 years they're still singing this piece. I mean, they probably had no expectation that 10 years from now this piece will still be sung.
A very different concept of public music making. This music in particular was written for a place and a time, for a particular church, for a specific church calendar day or holiday, and at Bach's passing, the name of Bach was associated with his children in London and throughout Germany. The Bach family name was known for generations as great musicians, and Bach in his lifetime was mainly known as an organist, not so much as a great composer, but as one of Europe's finest organists. And it really wasn't until 70 years after he died that Mendelssohn comes across some of his great music, which was consistently being studied. Mozart studied Bach and Handel, of course. But Mendelssohn had this idea. It's kind of an epiphany. Why don't I reperform the St. Matthew Passion? That would be a great, great idea.
Yeah, dust this off, pull this off of the shelf. And
exactly. And they sold over 1,000 tickets. They had to turn people away and had to set up other performances. So, Bach made quite a stir after he'd kind of gone away for a while, which happened to most composers. And I think of Bach a little bit like I think of Palestrina. He is the Lutheran church music, what Palestrina is to Roman Catholicism and the musical tradition there. He set the standard for what was to be expected as far as the integrity of music that was presented in the church and the legacy that just continued to move on. But Mendelssohn brought him back to to a popular level that Bach had never experienced in his lifetime.
Right, the general public.
And it just took off.
Right.
It just took off. And it's ebbed and flowed for a while, but we're in another period right now where Bach's music is very much sought after. There are professional choirs all over the world devoted to music of this period and really focusing on Bach and using the Bach's platform to do more obscure composers in his lifetime, Carl Grahn and some others like that, who were very fine composers. Nobody knows who they are, at least in this country. Very, very little knowledge of them except in academic circles. And so, Bach led to a revival of the music of his time, but also, again, has just become synonymous with great music and inspiring setting of religious texts.
I remember reading at one point, back to the point of that after his death, it was his sons who were much more famous, that for instance, in 1780, which would be about 30 years after Bach died, if you asked somebody about the music of Bach or mentioned the music of Bach, they would have thought you meant Johann Christian Bach or maybe Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. But no way would they think you were talking about Johann Sebastian Bach. And the fact that Bach was so tightly rooted in Germany of his life meant he was less of a cosmopolitan figure than Handel, for instance. So in some respects, it makes perfect sense that he would not have had widespread fame as a composer and just awaited rediscovery. And thank goodness for Mr. Mendelssohn, who helped facilitate that. He is not, however, an easy composer, particularly when it comes to his writing for vocalists. Have you and the group found this to be a very challenging program to prepare?
We have, and the Lessons and Carols program, the way it fits into our season, makes it even more difficult. Lessons and Carols is one of the programs we have the shortest rehearsal schedule for, because when you're dealing with community singing, your first program, getting the year started right, takes some time.
And you started with the Brahms Requiem, which
absolutely.
Is a big work.
So we've been reaching high this year, and the Bach has its moments of tremendous difficulty, and I'm real proud of the chorus. They've negotiated it very well. They're making some gorgeous sounds, and we have some of the area's best musicians as guests, a string quartet of principals and assistant principals from around area symphonies, and my great friend Suzanne Joffrey playing the oboe, and just one of the best oboists in southeastern Wisconsin. And so we have these very gifted players playing with us as well, which really kind of inspires the choir. And so it's taken it to a new level. We met with the orchestra for the first time last night and the choir, and you could just see the look on their eyes. It's so different than rehearsing with a piano. And suddenly it starts to come to life. You start imagining you could be back in the Thomas Kirke hearing Bach as it would have been done. You hear those oboes just start to soar above the orchestra and those fiery violin parts in the outset. And it's just, it's pretty exciting.
Wow.
And I feel a real connection to the history when I do. That's part of who I am, too. I love the fact that we're part of this connection of music that's been performed for, 350 years.
Let's talk quickly about the fact that you're doing it in two different places. And one I know is very familiar to you. You've done a lot of performances in that beautiful chapel at the Siena Center on the north side of Racine. I'm not sure how often you have performed at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford. But just say a word about the challenge of mounting a sort of two-tiered performance in which you are going to be making music in two different spaces. I'm not sure how radically different those two spaces are from each other.
They're pretty different. The convent at Siena Center has a really nice quality in that a large part of its space is very open, and you just can set up in ways that are very helpful to your choir, to your orchestra. But generally performing in churches, which is a pretty common venue for the Choral Arts Society and choirs like ours, each church presents its own challenge, the position of the instruments, the type of instruments that are there, immovable altars and immovable pews. Some places they move, some places they don't. And so in Siena, what the nice thing is that everything's pretty wide open. And we just set our chairs where we need to. And it's almost like a concert stage. You can really set it the way you need to. And the organs are all on, the instruments are all on wheels, so they all move. You can move the organ or the piano or whatever to wherever you need them. Going to a traditional church space almost always has its limitations. You want to be in the front of the church where the audience can see you. Often choirs are on the side or in the back of the church, and just not, it's not a satisfying experience a lot of times for audiences to come and not see what's happening. And so you try and make whatever adjustments you need to by putting a choir in maybe a slightly awkward position, and instrumentalists kind of packing them in wherever they fit best to create the sound you want, but also just to accommodate the space. So that's a unique challenge everywhere we go. Anybody who's been in a touring choir knows this. You get to a church for the first time and you go, oh, the organ's in the back. The venues where we're going to sing is in the front. Do we need a TV camera? You know, the organ's bigger or smaller than I thought. I'm not sure how well this piece is going to work in it. There's always these little challenges you find in the space. So there's a pillar somewhere. They gave you a picture of the space and you realize there's a couple of pillars like right in front of your choir. So doing performances like that presents some of the same challenges for us. But I can say after 30 years of going from church to church, we figured it out. It's fun.
Have you performed in St. Thomas before?
This is our third time.
Oh, okay.
And so we've
by now you know where the pillars are.
We know where the pillars are.
Very good. So if people are interested in attending either of these performances, and again, it's Saturday night, 7 p.m. at the Siena Center in Racine, or Sunday afternoon at 4 at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford, can people just show up and purchase a ticket at the door?
I am sure there will be tickets available at the door, so please feel free to come. If you have a last-minute thought that you'd like to do this, please do that. You can get tickets online on the Choral Arts Society website at choralartsonline.org. You can call the Choral Arts office and reserve a ticket. So at 634-3250. And you can also buy them at Julie's Personal Touch Flowers in Racine. So we have several venues to purchase tickets, and they will be available at the door.
Very good. And I know that one of the pieces scheduled to be performed is Bach's much-beloved Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring from Cantata 147?
Yep.
So I think that would be a nice way for us to bring things out. And I'm happy to say that Tom Buehler is in the house, and so part two of the morning show will be coming up momentarily. But in the meantime, James Schatzman, thank you for being here, and we wish you and the Choral Arts Society well with your performances this weekend.
Thanks, Greg.
the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. Again, that will be the focus of the Choral Arts Society and their performances this weekend of their annual Lessons and Carols, Saturday evening at the Siena Center in Racine, Sunday afternoon at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford. The time is 8:38. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and very happy to have now in the studios for part two of today's program, Tom Bueller, who is the president of Visioning a Greater Racine. And Claire Holland is with us as well, a board member for Visioning a Greater Racine, and she handles a lot of the communication matters for this organization. This organization exists really for the purpose of trying to help the city of Racine, its citizens, collectively vision what a greater Racine might look like, a place, the kind of community that we can all be proud to call home. And it is actually a long and somewhat complex process that is involved in all of this, and it's a process that is already underway and a process that is about to involve the public, which is why they are visiting the morning show today to talk about what this organization is really about, the kind of visioning that they hope is going to continue to occur, and what the ultimate goals are. So, Tom Bueller, Claire Holland, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. Tom, give us a little history lesson, if you would, in terms of how Visioning a Greater Racine initially formed. Sure. and at whose initiative?
Well, it was a few of us that were talking together about the strengths of Racine and also some of the challenges. And one of the things that seemed to be lacking was a long-term plan or outlook for the community of Racine. And I say community of Racine because actually our geographical scope is greater than the city of Racine.
That's right. You have Caledonia and other, everything east of
the eye, yes, in Racine County. And that's a very important aspect of what we're doing. So we thought that this community could use some more of an long-run outlook on things. And we learned about this process called visioning, or the fancier name is strategic community visioning. And it seemed like the perfect way to go about settling the, or filling the gap that seemed to be there.
I noticed that in this kind of, that the process has six different phases. So this is obviously not a case of you and your organization inventing the wheel, but this is a process that has been done in other places at other times. What can you tell us about this being done in other places and what can be learned from that?
Yeah, that's right, Greg. This has been carried out in communities around the country, and many of them having very good success with it. And two that we are studying specifically are Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Rockford, Illinois. Chattanooga, Tennessee started their visioning process in the mid-1980s when it woke up one day and saw on the cover of Time magazine that it had been dubbed the dirtiest city in America. If you go to Chattanooga now, if you go to downtown Chattanooga, you'll see a vibrant place where people are living, working, playing, and enjoying themselves, and a dramatic contrast to what it was 30 years ago. And the people there credit this visioning process with infusing the life and vitality into their downtown. Rockford, Illinois started their process 3 years ago, so obviously much more recent. And they are already seeing improvements and developments. And a really great sign of the progress there is that over 200 people are actively involved in this process on a regular basis, 200 volunteers that participate in what they call Transform Rockford. So it's been really fun to study these models, and we can use parts of them for Racine, but ultimately we're kind of fashioning our own way of doing it.
Mm. I'm just curious, too, is there anything to be learned from looking at the story of a city that attempts this but for whatever reason is not particularly successful? Because I would assume if this has been done a lot, it's done executed more effectively in certain cases, and maybe in other cases it's the wrong people and the wrong leadership roles or whatever, and it maybe does not work out well. Is there something to be learned from those stories as well?
Absolutely. And if there was such a place that we identified, we might want to go and visit there. There is a lot of literature, a lot of research that has been done on the community visioning process. And so I've read four or five case studies, and the ones that I've read were all about success stories, but there's probably research and literature out there about the ones that weren't so successful and what pieces were missing that prevented it from succeeding.
Right. Claire Holland, maybe you can help us kind of understand more about this term visioning. Probably one of those words that not all that long ago didn't even exist in the dictionary, at
right.
least, but now we hear it quite a lot. In what way is this term being used in this context?
Well, visioning in this context is very much about the process that we're using, but it's also about the purpose. The process is such that we're bringing a cross-section of the community together in a number of visioning sessions. Our goal is to have 2,000 people visioning in 200 sessions over the course of a number of months. We're part of the way there already because we have started that process. And visioning is all about looking into the future strategically, but asking a very pointed question: what do you want your community, i.e. Racine, east of the Eye, to look like in the year 2030? And speaking in small groups in these visioning sessions to draw that out of a cross-section of the community. And then compiling that data, looking for themes, and then acting on that data once we have a plan put together.
Right. So as I understand this process, the first phase was one of investigation. It sounds like that's what happened early on, looking at some success stories like Rockford and Chattanooga and so on. I noticed from the literature that the second phase about feasibility in part was to ask the question of, is visioning the right tool to use in our case? I'd love to know just a little bit about what those discussions were like, because I think some people might hear that and think, well, of course, visioning would always be a great idea, that's a great idea for any city to explore. I mean, was that really seriously examined, whether or not, in fact, this was a tool that made sense in this context?
It was. We carried out a feasibility study, and I mentioned Chattanooga, Tennessee. We actually hired the person who led that initiative in Chattanooga 30 years ago, and we hired her as a consultant. Her name is Eleanor Cooper. And Eleanor came to Racine, and one of her jobs was to interview people in the community. And I think she did 45 interviews with community leaders from business, government, education, nonprofits, and explained what visioning is and asked the question, is Racine ready for this? Could Racine benefit from it? And it was a resounding yes. There was some reservation in terms of feeling like, does this compete against things that are already going on? Could it be duplicative to things that are already going on? There was some concern that it would take up resources that are being needed for other initiatives. So we ran into a little bit of headwind, but the vast majority of people seemed to agree that it was a very good idea and something that would be timely for our community.
Right. The third phase, and I suppose, Claire, this is where a lot of your work comes in, is this matter of coordination. It speaks to those concerns that were just raised, the fact that it's not like people in the city of Racine are just, or the outlying communities are just sitting around doing nothing. There's all kinds of good work that's being done, and that it would be possible for somebody to come in and with some master plan that duplicates much of what's going on or shoves aside efforts that are already underway. It's really important to get organizations and groups, businesses and so on, that already are on
Absolutely.
The scene, part of this and connected to this. Tell us about the challenge of making that happen.
Well, as part of the process, the coordination phase of this is really about identifying and speaking to all of the efforts that are already ongoing, which are a number of those, and getting everyone on board that this is a process we can all benefit from. If you think about it in terms of steering a ship, if we all have the same destination in 2030, we can get there. But if we're going in different directions, it's less likely to be a success. So it's a very critical part of the process.
And I think our event on December 8th really exemplifies what Claire is talking about, because at the event, people will learn about visioning a greater Racine, but they're also going to hear from six or seven other community leaders about initiatives that are going on in the community right now to address some of the challenges. So there's going to be Mayor Dicker talking about community-oriented policing. Dr. Lowy Hawes will be talking about the school academies. Dr. Brian Albrecht, guy you know quite well,
will be talking. From across the hall.
We'll be talking about the Gateway Promise. Rodney Prunty of our Racine County United Way will be talking about the community school. That's a new effort on their part. County Executive Delgrave will be talking about a GED initiative that they have going on. And Mary Beth Aldrich will be talking about Racine Revitalization Partnership, which is taking a very aggressive approach to improving Racine's housing situation. So we want to share the stage with all of these initiatives, because ultimately we're all pulling for the same thing. And we want to be able to synchronize our efforts and, as Claire used the analogy of the boat, you know, to be rowing together in the same direction.
Right. When you say that we're all going after the same thing and so on, one of the challenges that is probably before you is that because you are encompassing such a significant area, you're also encompassing some very diverse communities. And that, for instance, the typical business owner in Caledonia and let's say an ordinary citizen in the inner city of Racine, life is probably very different for them, and priorities are very different for them, and so on. Just how steep a challenge is it to have citizens as different as the two I just imagined rowing in the same direction towards a common goal?
Well, absolutely, it's a challenge. And as you said, life is different for those different folks, those examples that you used. But on the other hand, it should be very clear that it's a very interdependent world that we live in, and that we in Racine are affected by things going on in China and Mexico. And so certainly, I happen to live in Caledonia. Certainly, I'm affected by what's happening in the city of Racine and vice versa. Now, not everyone gets that. And those that don't get it, we're probably not going to get to the table with us. But more and more people do get it. And if people give this a chance and they come and they listen, as Claire mentioned, we've done about 16 of these sessions already, and it's really fun to watch people interact with each other and hear ideas. You hear this comment, you know, I never heard that that was a problem for somebody before. I never thought that that would be an issue for somebody before. But when they hear it, they can understand why the perspective that this other person is offering.
I know that one of the concerns you have and highest priorities you have is around the notion of trust and building a sense of trust in this process and in the goal that that you are trying to sort of create together. What is sort of the concern about trust, and what are you trying to do in order to build trust, and between whom?
Well, one of the things that we've done is we created something called shared values. And we as a board created these, and then we have put them on our website. And we have gotten feedback from the community on those, and people support that. So the shared values create a context for what we're doing. We also have... during a visioning session, we have very strict ground rules of communication. So it's really important that people listen to and honor the words spoken by each participant. So we're very diligent about not having people speak over or try to change or modify what somebody else has said. And when somebody is listened to, that helps to build trust. We're also posting the results of our visioning sessions on our website for transparency purposes, so people can see that we've recorded the input word for word, and that's the information that we're going by. Visioning a Greater Racine also held a few listening sessions with leaders in our African American and Latino communities, and that was very interesting to get insights from them on the challenges of being a person of color in our community. And so I think that was a trust-building exercise that we did as well.
So how much more of this visioning phase has to go on in terms of these sessions where you are listening to the concerns and ideas of people from the community?
Well, so our goal initially is to hold 200 of these visioning sessions with about 2,000 people, so roughly 2% of the identified community. So far, we have had 14 sessions and with over 400 participants. So the math may be we had larger sessions than we actually planned on initially, which is great news.
So you're going to get to 2,000 fairly quickly.
We are. And we're having, as Tom mentioned earlier, we're having this large event on December 8th where we hope to, our goal is to get 400 people in one night. So we're holding it at Case High School on December 8th where we'll be talking about our rich history, our history as an invention city, all the efforts, as Tom said, that are incurring now, and doing a huge visioning session. So that event we're calling Invention City 2.0. And again, it's December 8th.
So that night is not just with these special guests giving speeches, but this is also, that is just one part of the evening, and the evening is also about listening.
That's right. It's a three-part evening. It's the past, it's the present, and it's the future. We're going to flip it around a little bit because we want people to talk about what they see or hope for the future first, and then hear about what's happening and a little bit about the past.
These visioning sessions, are they essentially by invitation only? I mean, obviously this event on December 8th is open to anybody who is interested to come.
Absolutely.
But otherwise, these other, for instance, these sessions that have already occurred, have they been kind of invitation-only sessions?
Not at all. I mean, word of mouth has been our best friend at this point, but we want everyone who feels a passion for the future of Racine to participate. If you don't mind, I'll give a plug to our email address where people can write to get more information. It's info@visioningagreaterracine.org. If you just write and say you want to sign up to be on our mailing list or information on the next session, we can get that to anybody and everybody who wants to participate, because that is a key part of the success, is to hear from everyone.
Right. To what extent has the, for instance, the city of Kenosha and, let's say, the governing bodies of other communities been on board with this right from the start?
Well, the city of Kenosha, not so much, but the city of
Racine. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I know you're right here on the border.
I thought you meant that.
Right.
The mayor of Racine is very supportive. Our county executive is very supportive. And the several of the town administrators and presidents have gotten on board. And I think that it's become clear to those folks that government can't do it by itself. The issues have become too complex. The demands of the society for accountability and transparency are stronger than ever. And meanwhile, the resources are shrinking. Government resources are shrinking. So it's no longer the era of planning on or expecting the government to take care of it. But neither business can do it by itself either, or neither nonprofit organizations can do it by themselves. So there's no way that we're going to get the kind of future that we all want for our children without all of these sectors working together, and the visioning process allows for that.
Hmm. Well, and it's an exciting possibility, that's for sure. And as we said, a lot of work has already been done. How long ago did all of this begin?
2 years ago, Craig.
And how long do you envision this going on from here, or is that unclear?
Well, it will go on for as long as we have ideas coming from the community that are actionable projects or initiatives. So once the visioning is done, we go into the implementation phase. Visioning a Greater Racine will be the facilitator of the ideas and the projects that come up, connecting those people that are interested in them with resources that are available in the community.
Excellent. And of course, the ultimate goal is for this to be a even better community than it already is by the year 2030 and from there beyond.
Exactly.
Claire, remind our listeners about this very special event coming up on the 8th of December.
Happy to do that. December 8th, Invention City 2.0, between 6 and 8 p.m. at Case High School. What else can I tell you? If you forget, you can email info@visioningagreaterracine.org. But just remember, December 8th, you can show up. No need to sign up and be there by 6.
Sounds like an exciting event from 6 to 8 on the 8th of December. Claire Holland is a member of the board of Visioning a Greater Racine, and Tom Bueller is the president. It's great to have both of you here on The Morning Show today. Thank you so much, and best wishes as this exciting